Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the third lecture and the second week of this course. We are slowly getting to ADS CFT correspondence. Probably we'll reach it only next week, but we shall see. So anyway, let me briefly recapitulate what we have done last week. So basically, I tried to convince you that black holes, although classically they don't seem like, when you take quantum effects into account, they are thermodynamic objects, and they can be assigned temperature, which is like the surface gravity divided by 2 pi, and it's also related to the periodicity of imaginary time of your solution. And they can be also assigned an entropy, which is typically area over 4. That will be true in Einstein's gravity, coupled to anything, basically, almost. If you go beyond Einstein gravity, if you consider Gauss-Bonnet gravity or higher curvature gravities and stuff like that, this law will modify. Okay, it will no longer be area over 4, but there will be some corrections to that. And possibly, you know, this entropy somehow characterizes or counts microscopic degrees of freedom of the black hole. So, you know, it will be exponential of this S will give you how many states you have in the black hole. So now I also showed you how to calculate this entropy using the Euclidean trick. And basically what you do is that you use thermodynamic machinery. So you know that the entropy is given by the derivative of the free energy with respect to the temperature. And the free energy is given by minus T logarithm of the partition function. So now the trick how to calculate this partition function is that in the WKB approximation to the leading order, it is given by the Euclidean action of the corresponding solution, so of the classical solution, divided by beta. So all you have to do, basically, you know, to evaluate the partition function is to calculate the Euclidean action for your given solution, for your Schwarzschild black hole or whatever. So now this Euclidean action has a couple of pieces. And of course, you know the Einstein-Hilbert piece, which is just this piece over here, which gives you the right Einstein equations. However, it's not a well-posed variational principle because apart from the derivatives of the metric on the boundary, this thing here also contains terms which are proportional to derivatives of that boundary metric. And so you would have to prescribe not only how the metric looks like on the boundary, but also how the derivatives look on the boundary. So to cure this situation, York came with this prescription. So basically, you add a boundary term to this. K is the extrinsic curvature. You have calculated it, so you know how to deal with this. However, even if you so that yields your variational principle well posed. Now you can only impose the metric on the boundary. However, if you are interested in things like thermodynamics, you actually are interested in the value of the action itself, and so you have to tune the value of the action. If you just calculate these two terms, you find infinity. And so you have to renormalize it, basically. And so then you need to add these counter terms. And typically what is used in flat space as a counter term is people just subtract. They take some background. They call it G0. There will be corresponding metric G0, which asymptotically should look like your G, but can be very, very different inside the space-time. And then what you do is that you basically subtract the corresponding extrinsic curvature here so that this tunes the value of the action, for example, for flat space to be 0 and so on. So this is called background subtraction. It was used by Gibbonson Hawking. And so it is still used in flat space because people simply did not find a better way how to do it in flat space. And so, of course, this is very non-unique because you can, you don't know what really to take as a background. You don't know how to do it properly, really. For simple cases, it's some simple prescriptions, but for a general case, nobody knows how to do this. So really, this is somehow, some kind of ad hoc prescription how to actually get rid of the divergences. So somehow this term is sometimes called Gibbons-Hawking term, whereas actually really the Gibbons-Hawking term is this K0 here. And the first guy who came with this K prescription is York. So okay. We have also seen that in asymptotically flat spacetimes, Schwarzschild is not, thermodynamics of Schwarzschild is actually not very well defined because the Schwarzschild has negative specific heat, and so it cannot be in thermal equilibrium with the surrounding radiation. Are there any questions about this? Yes?
What if we include first order corrections to the entropy?
Well, first of all, what would be the motivations to do that, right? So are you including some quantum fluctuations which you haven't taken into account and stuff like that? So that would be one possibility. I don't know what happens with C in that case, but certainly people try to go beyond as A over 4 or even going beyond, you know, if you have more complicated theories, your temperature will not be given by kappa over 2 pi, but they can be some other corrections as well. So in principle, you know, once you start modifying things, maybe you can upgrade this. But I don't think it's something that, you know, there's a consensus on how to do this properly.
I think I hear people saying that even from a quantum theory, we are expecting this entropy formula to come up. But even at the classical level, you see that there are quantum corrections. Then why do we expect A over 4 from a quantum theory?
So typically what you do is that you get this as a leading order, A over 4, and then you get logarithmic corrections and stuff like that. But I don't remember what this does for your C and stuff like that, so we would have to look it up. But I think, you know, it's something that people expect, but nobody really proved that it must be so, I think. So anyway, okay, so this is basically the situation in asymptotically flat case. But let's now move to the ADS case, so ADS black holes. And we have seen last time that these are simply black holes, which are, again, solutions of Einstein equations. But now they are solutions of Einstein equations with the cosmological constant, which is negative. So solutions, black hole solutions of Einstein equations, which are g mu nu plus lambda g mu nu equals to 8 pi g newton t mu nu. And lambda here is negative, and in four dimensions, it's simply given by 3 over L square. So it has dimensions 1 over N square, and L here is called ADS radius. It tells you how much ADS you are. Okay? If you send L to infinity, of course, this is 0, and you are back to the asymptotically flat case. Okay? So now, interestingly, once you consider these types of black holes, many things here become simpler and actually more well-defined. And so what is the corresponding action? So in this case, subtraction procedure is no longer required. And that is a unique local action which you can write down, which actually renormalizes for any solution. So you can, so there is a local Euclidean action and there's a nice prescription for these counterterms, what they have to be, so that your action actually is finite and nice. And actually you can derive that prescription yourself next week. You will have it as your homework to do this for the scalar field as a practice, because scalar field typically easier to renormalize. However, you can do it for the metric in this exactly similar way, and that would give you what I'm just going to tell you. So in this case, the Euclidean action is given, well, you will still have the Einstein-Hilbert term, but now we have lambda as well. So you probably know from your GR course that I have to subtract minus 2 lambda, and that's what gives me Einstein equations. So it will be 1 over 16 pi g newton integral over omega d4x. And now we have r. It must be square root of g somewhere. Square root of g. We have r. And if you want to include a cosmological constant, you do minus 2 lambda. Minus 2 lambda. But lambda is minus 3 over L square. So it's plus 6 over L square. Square, so this is minus 2 lambda. This is how you would get Einstein equations with cosmological constant. So if you vary that, you get these equations here. And then we have the boundary term, And of course, the boundary term has to have this York term here. So it'll be d3x square root of h. And we have the k here. And then we need to have the counterterms, right? And the counterterms are, you know, precisely given what you need to have. And they are nicely expressed in terms of the invariance of the boundary metric. OK, and so they read minus 2 over L is the first term, and then minus L over 2 reaches scalar of the metric H. And then if you go to higher dimensions, then you need extra more terms. But what is really nice, so these are the counterterms. But they can, well, what is amazing about them is they are just, you know, invariants constructed from the boundary metric. Constructed from H mu nu, from the boundary metric. And so it's super simple to evaluate it. You don't need to think about anything. You don't need to think about what kind of, you know, background metric G0 I have to choose, and so on. All you have to do is that you identify a boundary metric, and you calculate the corresponding Ricci scalar. You calculate the cosmological constant. And you know, there will be some other terms in higher dimensions. But in four dimensions, this is it. But if you want to go to six dimensions, there will be two more counter terms and stuff like that. So increasing number of dimensions, more counter terms you need. Okay, but this is obtained by standard renormalization. Okay, so it comes from renormalization. And you will discuss this yourself in homework 2 for scalar field. For scalar field. And of course, for for the metric, it's the procedure is exactly the same, but it's more complicated a little bit. Yes?
You mentioned that the thing here that's well defined is the local action? Or?
So what I mean by this is that really, what I mean here is that really, you know, all these terms are local, right? Ricci scalar is local thing or whatever, right? So you have nice prescription, which is local. It's given by an integral over invariants here, which are locally constructed out of the boundary metric. That's what I mean by that. Okay, and so this is so amazing that really people came up with this prescription. And if you ask who, then it's nobody else than our director Rob Myers. Actually, you know, he gave this prescription here and work on these things. Okay? So now, if you take this action here and you vary it, right? So now, if you do delta SE, well, then schematically, you get the boring term, which is something delta G mu nu, okay? Which, of course, better be these Einstein equations here. So let's write Einstein equations here. Okay, but then of course you get also a boundary term. So you get plus d omega, and the boundary term is let's put minus 1/2 so that we have the same conventions. Why not minus 1/2? Square root of h d3x, and then tau ab delta hab. Okay, so you get a boundary term, and this is it. Okay, so this is the boundary term here, but you don't get any term. So if you didn't include this k term, you would also have a term which would be delta of the normal derivative of this hab. Right, and so then I would have to prescribe not only delta HAB, so and there is no this term delta normal derivative HAB simply not there because we killed it by putting the K term over there. Right, so we can all really impose just delta HAB equals to zero on the boundary, And we can impose that the Einstein equations are satisfied, and that's what the variational principle gives us, right? Okay.
Sorry, what's out?
Aha, very good. I'll just tell you. Thanks for that question. So now you can calculate what this tau AB is, right? So I'm giving you a prescription. This is your action. You just vary it with respect to the boundary metric. So of course, the first term does not have that, but the other two terms, they depend on H, right? So you just take it and you vary it, right? And what do you get, okay? So what you get where this 8 pi, probably G Newton, G Newton is 1 at this point. And then what you get is K HAB minus KAB plus L GAB of H minus 2 over L HAB. Okay. So this thing here. So this is really you take your action, you vary it with respect to H, and this is what you get. That tau AB reads like this. So now these first two terms, they come from the K term. If you vary K with respect to HAB, you can try that. Probably Roos did that. Okay? So if you attended gravitational physics course, you have seen this thing here. So this thing here is she probably told you something related to Israel junction conditions. If you want to put some matter on the delta like hypersurface or something like that. So this was known by Israel, and it comes from varying the K part. And then if you look at this piece here, then that's the correction due to the ADS counter term. So comes from counter term. Okay, but if you look at what the counter term really is, well, it is 2 over L, so it's a constant, it's like lambda, and then it's a Ricci scalar times something, right? So if you vary those, you must get something like Einstein equations, right? So I must get GAB plus a cosmological constant. This is precisely what you get from there, right? So it's super simple to basically guess that, right? So you have this and that. Okay, so that's your prescription for tau AB, what that tau AB is. So now what is really funny is that if you calculate this tau AB in the ADS case, what do you think the value of this guy is? Is it 1, 0, infinity? Who thinks it's 0? Who thinks it's infinity? Okay, some people think it's infinity. Of course it's infinity, right? Because that's how we constructed these counter terms, so that we kill the infinity there, right? So there's some infinity. If you don't include the counter terms, there'll be infinity. So we include the counter terms, they have to be infinite, right? So that we get a finite value. So this thing here is actually infinite energy momentum tensor, right? However, it's an energy momentum tensor because you get it by varying the action with respect to the metric. Right, so that's what the energy momentum tensor is, but the infinity is sort of trivial, and so if you actually get a finite piece out of that, so it will be something like 1 over epsilon. So if you regularize it, it will be something like 1 over epsilon to some power, right? And then finite piece. Okay, so now you take that finite piece, so taking a finite piece of this. You get something which is very, very important for ADS-CFT. It will be the energy momentum tensor of your conformal field theory. But your conformal field theory is quantum. So this will be an expectation value of the energy momentum tensor of the CFT. This gives expectation value value of CFT energy momentum tensor. Okay, so really you take this tau AB, this will be of the form 1 over epsilon to some power times a finite piece. That finite piece is the energy momentum tensor of your conformal field theory, which lives on the boundary. Yes?
But one-point functions in CFTs are zero. So why? But this is non-zero, the finite piece.
So this will be non-zero, certainly non-zero. What you will find is that the trace of this thing here will be zero. But the energy momentum tensor is not zero. It is traceless, but why would you say that the energy momentum tensor is zero? Like field theory can have some energy.
Correlation functions of the energy momentum.
Yeah. But T mu is something like quadratic typically, right? So T mu is quadratic in the field. No, it's not zero. Right? So now what you can do, well, you have your, so, okay, very good. So let's call it something like 1 over epsilon to some power and the expectation value of tau AB. That's our CFT energy momentum tensor. Okay. And then you may be thinking, well, okay, very good. So now I have energy momentum tensor for the CFT. I can use this. The CFT will live in flat space, so I can use every intuition I have from flat space. And you can calculate things like energy, right? Energy is given by the integral of energy density over volume of the CFT, right? The energy density of which you extract from energy momentum tensor is just given by T00 component, right? So something like integral over T00 should give you something like energy of the CFT. Okay, what do you think you will find for Schwarzschild ADS black hole? What is the energy of the CFT? What is the energy of the space-time? Sorry? It's?
M.
And you'll find this is equal to M. So you just prove for a specific case of Schwarzschild ADS that energy of the CFT is the same as the energy of the space-time. So energy, there will be a dictionary translating quantities of the CFT to quantities of the black hole. And so we just sort of shown on a specific example that the energy is actually in this dictionary is the same. So energy of the CFT will translate to the mass of the space-time or energy of the space-time. So similarly, you know, if you had rotation, momentum or whatever. So how would you calculate the rotation? I don't know. So momentum, you would calculate T0i, right? And the rotation would be related to something like 2ij or something like that. So similarly, you would find that if you calculate the standard prescription for the angular momentum out of your energy momentum tensor, you would find that this is given by the angular momentum in the space-time, okay? So you would find that angular momentum of the space-time of CFT is actually equal to J, which is the angular momentum of the space-time, and stuff like that. So you can start mapping, you know, the quantities in your ADS space, what are the properties of the black hole, if you want, to the properties of your CFT by just standard calculation using this energy momentum tensor here. Okay. So very good. So now, let me just make one very confusing remark on this. So we will learn that, you probably know, but that if you have CFT, then the energy momentum tensor has to be traceless. Okay, so CFT, so remark, CFT has traceless. We will show that in one of the tutorials, energy momentum tensor. So this guy here better be traceless, okay? If you attend the truth course, you know there's some weird identities between the extrinsic curvature And the intrinsic things like the Ricci scale and stuff like that is called something like Gauss identities or something like that. So using these Gauss identities, you can easily show this tau AB indeed is traceless. Okay, so indeed, you will find that tau AA is equal to zero. Okay, so as a check, that's really we are talking about the CFT here. So now, very, very confusing remark, okay? If tau AB is traceless, which means tau AA is zero, right? What happens if I add here a term plus delta square root of h tau AB HAB here? What is this term here, if I did add it here?
Zero.
It will be zero, right? Because this guy here is traceless. But if I add this term here, what happens? Well, this thing here will have two pieces. It will have delta on this guy, and it will have delta on that guy. Delta on that guy cancels delta on this guy here, right? So what I will be left with, I will have basically have a term, something like HAB delta square root of H tau AB, right? Something like this. So by adding zero, you can sort of change the requirement on your boundary conditions. So before, we required that delta HB be fixed on the boundary. If I add this zero here, in our case, now we can equally express this as expressing that this guy here on the boundary is equal to zero, right? But what is tau AB? Tau AB contains this extrinsic curvature. The extrinsic curvature contains information about the derivatives of the metric on the boundary. So in some sense, you are showing that equivalently, you can write this as Dirichlet boundary condition problem, or you can sort of write it as a Neumann boundary problem, because now you can fix some derivatives of the boundary metric. It's not entirely true, because this tau AB not only contains the derivatives of the metric, but also contains the metric itself. So it is, but sometimes people call this like the Neumann problem, okay? Whether this is justified completely, it's not clear. So forget about this comment, okay? It's just confusing. Questions? So really the beauty here is that by calculating this energy momentum tensor, basically you know everything about your CFT, and you can start building dictionary between the quantities in the space-time and the quantities of the CFT. I haven't shown you that this is really the expectation value of the CFT. That will be next week or the week after that, okay? But it's true, and you can start calculating. Okay, so second remark. Oh no, I'm so chatty. Sorry. So second thing is, let's consider this Schwarzschild ADS black hole for simplicity. And you will have a homework on this. You have a homework on this, but I want to tell you sort of spoil the result for you, so that it's, if you attend this lecture, so that you can do the homework in 20 minutes or something like that, right? So the Schwarzschild ADS black hole simply looks like this: minus f dt squared plus dr squared over f plus r squared d omega squared, where this f 1 minus 2m over r plus r squared over l squared. So this is the effect of the cosmological constant. Okay? And okay, so now you can start studying the properties of this solution. You can calculate what is the temperature, 1 over beta. You can repeat the derivation we have done in the lecture last time. You will find that this is simply given by the prescription. You take this metric function, you differentiate it with respect to r, you plug there r plus, which is the horizon radius, divided by 4, and that's what gives you the temperature. And it comes out to be l squared plus 3 r plus squared. You will show this in your homework, don't worry. 4 pi L squared R plus. Okay, so that's the temperature. You can also calculate the partition function by calculating what is the value of this Euclidean action. Okay, it's some kind of calculation. You will probably spend a couple of hours doing that. So I don't ask you to do that. Instead, I ask you to believe in thermodynamics. The free energy is internal energy minus TS. Okay, so the free energy better be equal to internal energy is the mass, okay, minus TS. Okay, S is, we are still in Einstein gravity. So S is area over 4, T we know. M, well, better be this M here. Otherwise, why we would call it M, right? So this is the energy in the space-time. Okay, so you calculate this, and you find that it's equal to R plus L squared minus R plus squared divided by 4 L squared. Okay, so this is what you find in your homework. And then you may be thinking, well, okay, very good. So now I have how my free energy looks like, how my temperature looks like. You can verify that dF over dT gives you the entropy area over 4 if you want to. But let's plot how this free energy looks like. Okay, and what you will find, so this is the free energy. And you can plot it as a function of temperature. Okay, so the free energy is a function of temperature. So whereas the internal energy satisfies dm equals to tds, this is a Legendre transformation of that. So it satisfies df is minus sdt. So free energy is a function of temperature. Okay. And then you can start plotting this. But of course, you see, well, it's difficult to express f as a function of t here, because this is some, you know, what do you solve for, right? Either for R plus or for L, you plug it there, I don't know. It's quite complicated. Instead, you have a computer. You can plot it parametrically, varying R plus, right? So this depends on R plus, this depends on R plus. I can plug in R plus is 1, this gives me a number, this gives me a number, I can plot it. Okay, so you plot this parametrically, and what you find is that if R plus is really small, you start over here. So this is how R plus is increasing, okay? You start somewhere at very, very high temperatures. If R plus is really, really small, R plus is small, T is big, okay? So you start here, and then you keep going until some point. And at that point, which you will find in your homework, suddenly the behavior is completely different, and you have increasing R plus like this. So there is a cusp in your free energy thing, okay? So now, you will plot it, don't worry. So now, the value of R plus at this cusp is something, right? It must be some characteristic scale which is present in your space-time. What is the characteristic scale present in your space-time?
Horizon.
Sorry? R plus is the horizon, exactly, so that's one characteristic scale. Do we have another characteristic scale in the space-time? L. Very good. So, you know, when the ratio of the two is something like 1, something happens. Okay, so when you know, so this is roughly R plus equals to L, is where the cusp is located. So this thing here have R plus smaller than L. This thing here have R plus bigger than L. That's why these things here are called small black holes. Small. And these things here are called large black holes, because they have R plus bigger than L. Okay, so these are large. Okay, you will calculate the specific heat what is of the corresponding black hole. Okay, so what do you think about these black holes? Will the specific heat be positive or negative? So these black holes are really, really small. Do they know about that they are in ADS? They are teeny tiny black hole. ADS radius is huge with respect to this radius, right? So the black hole seems like it's in asymptotically flat case. It doesn't know anything about L because the radius of the black hole is too small. So these things have to behave like Schwarzschild-like because they don't know about the ADS scale. Small black holes, which are Schwarzschild-like, And because we know that Schwarzschild has negative specific heat, well, it's reasonable to conjecture that these will have negative specific heat. So these are unstable. So C is negative here, okay? And they are thermodynamically unstable. On the other hand, large black holes are definitely affected by the ADS thing. And what you will show is that they have positive specific heat. So they can be thermodynamically stable with the radiation, okay? So you'll show this again. So last thing. So far, we have been playing just with black holes. Yes?
Ask a question. When we say specific heat, do we mean with respect to some fixed parameter, thermodynamic parameters?
So it's the standard formula for the specific heat, right? So I don't know, what is it, dS over dt or something like that?
Yeah, but we have to consider
it. So, yeah, so what we are fixing here is the cosmological scale. So L is fixed. So when you calculate dS over dt, basically what you are doing is just differentiating with respect to R plus. So R plus, yeah. So yeah, so you are calculating CP. CL. L is fixed. So you can have very specific heats depending on what is fixed and stuff like that. Here we are calculating CL. L is fixed. Okay. So now what we haven't taken into account here is that this is not the whole system. There is also a radiation, okay? And so radiation radiation is something which is causing your ADS to be thermal. So the question was, you know, how much radiation I have to put so that, you know, this is at given temperature stable and nice in your ADS space. And this was actually estimated by Hawking and Page. In 1983, I think. And what they have shown is that compared, so then you're asking, what is the free energy of this radiation? Like, it's like normal blackbody radiation, but now in ADS, right? So that's something which can exist at a given temperature. It's like black, yeah. So what they estimated is that the free energy of this radiation is teeny tiny with respect to the free energy of the black hole. So it is a little bit negative, but it's really, really small. So what you can really take for most of the thing is that the free energy of the radiation is something like zero. It's a little bit negative and whatever, but it's almost zero. So then you have, this is your radiation phase. Okay. And now your thermodynamics kick in and you are asking, well, what is the stable situation? What is the thermodynamically preferred situation for your system, which consists of radiation and black holes? And the answer for thermodynamics is, well, the one which globally minimizes the free energy. Okay, very good. So what is the global minimum of the free energy in this region? It's the black holes. Okay, so this thing here is the thermodynamically preferred thing over here. But what about the temperatures lower than this? So if I continue to be a black hole, the free energy of the radiation is smaller. So actually, what happens is that this is the preferred free energy for the temperatures smaller than this. Okay. So now you see, if you look at this global minimum, it's over here, it's over there. It's continuous everywhere, but the derivative at this point is not. Okay. So this temperature is called T. Hawking Page. And at this temperature, the free energy, the global minimum of the free energy is continuous, but the derivatives are not. So there will be a first order phase transition. At T. Hawking Page, we have first order phase transition. Which, to everybody's surprise, is called Hawking-Page phase transition. Okay, and what it basically means is that if you have small temperatures, right? Imagine you have ADS filled with radiation. Now you start increasing the temperature, right? The radiation is happy until T Hawking-Page, and if you try to heat it up even more, the radiation is no longer happy and collapses to form a large black hole, and that's the Hawking-Page phase transition. Okay, so you know, black holes in ADS are thermodynamically very interesting. They show very interesting phase transitions. Okay. However, this is not the whole story. So we have like radiation, large black hole phase transition. Okay. This is what happens in the bulk of the space-time. This is what happens in our space-time. However, in ADS-CFT, whatever happens in the bulk of the space-time, something corresponding happens for your field theory on the boundary. Okay? And so what was conjectured is precisely this first-order phase transition of Hawking-Page corresponds to confinement, deconfinement phase transition of your quark-gluon plasma. Okay, so in ADS-CFT, and so on CFT side, this corresponds to something like confinement deconfinement. Phase transition of quark gluon plasma. Okay, and if you want to read more, it's a paper by this, by Witte in 98. I think it's 98. Okay, so now. Isn't this amazing, right? So not only you can have black holes with positive specific heat, but these black holes actually show some interesting phase transitions, and these phase transitions should be relevant for, early universe of our universe, right? Or for phase transitions in our early universe. Questions? Yes.
The small sort of confusion that I have, I don't know if it's apparently relevant, but is it true that in
we have ADS 5 cross S 5 on the bulk, and then on the boundary we have n equals 4 super Youngmans. Is it true that n equals 4 confines? It doesn't confine.
No. So very good. This is a very good question. Remember that question. So what? Okay. So what I will show you is that there is some motivation from string theory. Thinking about precisely what you just said, ADS5 cross S5 / CFT4, right? There are some less vague derivatives. So it's a motivation. It's not really a proof. Okay, even that is not proved. But then you can go beyond this, and you know you can do even more vague proof or something like ADS whatever CFT3 and you know other cases. But of course, if we talk about quark gluon plasma, we talk about something which is not a CFT, right? And so this goes beyond anything proven. This is basically like a conjecture, right? It's conjecture beyond conjecture. Okay, so but anyway, what I will try to show you is that out of this conjecture, you can get some real calculations, and these real calculations sort of correspond to what you see in LHC and what could have happened in the early universe. So you know, this is going beyond, you know, the ADS-CFT. And this is very important to keep in mind that, you know, everything has not been proven really, and despite that it has not been proven in the simplest case, people go beyond it and they think it's more generally applicable, and they use it for calculations, and these calculations typically give some good results actually. So it's an evidential case for ADS-CFT rather than a mathematical proof. This is a very good question. So keep that in mind for the whole course, okay? More questions? If not, let's start chapter 2. We have 15 minutes, but we have already seen everything, so it's fine. So chapter 2, motivation, or stringy motivations. Equations for ADS-CFT But we will really do only ADS. So you will do precisely ADS 5, Gosses 5, CFT 4 example. Okay. But why I want to do this is that we will also encounter some equations which will be actually used for some calculations later, right? And so, who has taken the string theory course? Who hasn't taken the string theory course? Okay, so everybody knows more about string theory than I do. It's perfect. But basically, what is string theory? Is a quantum theory of relativistic strings. But not only strings themselves, but there are some also higher dimensional objects. And higher dimensional objects. Okay, so that's what string theory is. But fortunately, I already, whatever we shall basically need, I already told you in the classical physics course, right? So you already know how to deal with relativistic strings, and that's how you start dealing with things. So remember that if you have point particle, so basically what I will draw is a few cartoons, and that's the exposure to string theory which you will need. So for point particle, we know that the point particle simply sweeps out a trajectory. So this is just a repetition from the classical physics course, okay? And so we have the trajectory, and the trajectory is just x mu parameterized by some parameter, x mu of lambda. Right? And so this is the word line. So now if you want an object which is more dimensional, let's say a string, then this thing here will not be just a point at a given instant of time, but it will be an extended object. And so the whole thing will sweep rather some kind of sheet. Right? So for string, again, so this is x. So now we have something like this, and that sweeps a trajectory like that. And so now we can introduce, so in order to parameterize a two-dimensional surface, you need two coordinates. You need, let's say, tau and sigma, or lambda and sigma. So let's put lambda like this, and sigma like that. And so basically, you get this embedding of the string trajectory into the spacetime as a function of lambda and sigma, right? Okay. So now we have more sheet instead of the word line. Okay, so now if you want to know how this behaves if you have free particle or free string, it's given by these Nambu-Goto actions, which we discussed in the classical physics course. So in this case, you know that the action for the point particle, which is a function of the trajectory of the particle, it's simply given by minus m0 d tau, but you can write d tau as dx mu over dt, dx nu over dt eta mu nu square root of that. So this is equal to minus m0 integral eta mu nu dx mu dt, or d lambda, right? D lambda, dx nu, d lambda, and there must be a minus sign here because the trajectory is time-like, which you can write, as we have done already, as minus n0 integral, and now something minus determinant of g lambda lambda d lambda, where this g lambda lambda is precisely this. So chi lambda lambda is eta mu nu dx mu d lambda dx nu d lambda. Okay, so what this thing here is an induced metric on your worksheet, right? So you take this metric eta mu nu. These guys are projectors which project from the space-time with coordinates x mu onto the trajectory of the particle. So dx mu over d lambda is a projector. You are projecting one index of the metric. You are projecting the other index of the metric. So this is the induced metric. Metric on particle's trajectory. Right, and so, of course, this thing here has only one component, g gamma lambda lambda. It's just one thing. So the determinant of a number is a number, right? And so I can write it as determinant of g lambda lambda or g lambda gamma lambda lambda. It doesn't matter, right? So here you have seen this, right? So now, if you want this for string, it's exactly the same thing. You have to find what is the induced metric on this, you know, worksheet, right? And that will be given by the metric projected onto the worksheet. But now on the worksheet, worksheet is not only described by lambda, but it's also described by sigma. So we'll have two coordinates. So let's, just to simplify our life, let's call these coordinates xi a, okay? So these guys here, lambda and sigma, let's call them xi a. There's two of them, lambda and sigma. And so we can get the induced metric. So now, for the string, the induced metric is gamma AB. It will be 2 by 2 matrix, right? And let's just remember that this gamma AB comes from the Minkowski metric in the spacetime where the string propagates at this point, okay? We could, of course, then generalize it to curved spacetime. If the string propagates in curved spacetime of arbitrary metric G mu nu, well, you know that for point particle, if you want to propagate point particle in arbitrary curved spacetime, you just change eta mu nu to G mu nu, right? So that's how you do it. So the same thing will be here. Okay, so gamma AB of eta is just d x mu d xi a d x nu d xi b eta mu nu. Okay, so that's what the induced metric is. And once we have the induced metric, we can write down the action. And the action will extremize the induced metric, well, the induced volume of the worksheet. And so as Nambu Goto, which is a function of x mu of the string, is given by something like minus m0, so minus tp, integral square root of minus det of this gamma ab. And you have to integrate it. Sorry, it's not enough space. S n g of x mu is minus tp integral square root of minus that gamma a b d. And now for the string p is 1, so you have just two coordinates xi. But if you have more dimensional objects, then there will be p plus 1 of these coordinates. And so this is a motion of an arbitrary p brain. Okay, so this is forward p brain. This guy is the tension of that t brain. It's like the mass for the point particle, something which carries energy, right? Questions? So we've seen this, and we will use this in our course to calculate some interesting quantities. Okay, so that's why I need to repeat this. because we will use this Nambuko to action to actually calculate something interesting. Yes?
When you say P brain, is it the same thing as DP brain?
Sort of yes and no. You will see. You will see. So this is just, you know, at this point, this is just a relativistic extended object which has, you know, P plus one dimensional worksheet, right? And it's relativistic. And what we are really doing here, when we vary this action with respect to x mu, we are extremizing the worksheet or word volume of those things. So in the same way as the point particle, we are extremizing the proper time. Here we are extremizing like the sheet that it sweeps in the space-time. Okay. Very good. So that you can do your tutorial tomorrow. I also want to remind you about this other type of action, which is the Polyakov action, right? And so we will stop there then. So we also have better action. Let's put this up. So put this down. And so basically, again, as I tried to convince you in the classical physics course, is that this action is super, super nice. It has some super nice geometrical meaning, extremizing the worksheet and stuff like that. But it's complicated because of the square root. And so you can upgrade it. You can write a classically equivalent action, which does not have that square root. And by the way, also works for massless objects. And in string theory, the strings which people consider are massless. So that's a good thing. So remind, instead of Nambu-Goto action, we can consider. We can consider classically equivalent Polyakov action. Okay. And so how the Polyakov action looks for particle, we have seen that. We have symbols, but anyway. So now for point particle. Polyakov for point particle. Basically, what you do is that you introduce another field, which I called in classical physics E. Let's call it H here. Why not? It's something which is a function of your lambda parameter or whatever. But now we have sort of like action which depends not only x mu, but also on this H, which is treated as a new field. And it's given by 1 over half, 1 half. H minus 1, eta mu nu, dx mu over d lambda, dx nu over d lambda, minus m0 square h d lambda. Okay? So this is how it looks like for the point particle if you open your classical physics notes, except that what I called E there is now called H. This is, of course, 1 over h, right? It's a function. So this is the same action, okay? And the advantage of this action is that first you can take m0 goes to 0, considering massless particles, right? So that was one advantage. Second advantage, it doesn't have the square root. So it actually is nice and quadratic in your coordinates. And the way how you show that this is classical equivalent is that you vary this action with respect to h. So if you do delta h, and you write down the equation of motion, which is, I think we have done that in classical physics, you find that h is given by 1 over m0 square root minus eta mu nu dx mu d lambda dx nu d lambda. So this is your equation of motion coming from varying this with respect to h. And if you plug it back here, you get back to your Nambu-Goto action as you know it. Okay, so this is four-point particle. Now, for the string, it's exactly the same thing. So for a string, again, your action will be a function of x mu, but now our auxiliary variable h will be a matrix, 2x2 matrix. So it will carry index a and b. Okay, and this is given by minus 1 over 4 pi alpha prime, why not, integral d2 psi. Now h ab gamma ab. So that's the product of action for the string. Where this gamma AB is precisely the induced metric, which I, this one over here, right? So the gamma AB is that induced metric over there, right? But now you see that this is precisely in the same equivalence. So this was the gamma lambda lambda thing. So what we had the term was H minus 1 gamma lambda lambda, and then we had the mass term, right? Here we have H minus 1, if HAB is a metric, HAB with index upstairs is H minus 1, right? So that's the inverse metric. Gamma AB, there is no massive term. These are massless strings, okay? Massless strings. Okay, and of course, if I compare this with the Nambu-Goto, so you will show that this is classical equivalent to the Nambu-Goto action in your tomorrow's tutorial. Again, how you do that is you vary with respect to HAB. You find an equation of motion for HAB. You plug it back here, and you return back to the Nambu-Goto action. Okay, so you will do it in your tutorial tomorrow. It's easy peasy. Of course, what this means here is that this thing here is somehow related to the tension. And the traditional thing is that the tension of the string is given by 1 over 2 pi alpha prime. And if you look at the dimensionality of these things, right? So h is dimensionless, gamma is dimensionless. This has dimensions of length square. So alpha prime has to have dimensions of length square. Okay, alpha prime, by definition, is given by string length square. Okay? Okay, so it's just how we express the tension here. Okay, let me stop here. Questions? Yes?
It's in the same question that I asked before, because I don't understand like why that can be non-zero. Because like I understand that it will not be just one field, but it will have dependent one space-time point. I would think that even in a QFT that has no conformal symmetry, the expectation value of an operator that is not a scalar field could be zero, because you would break Lorentz symmetry.
Yeah, I don't know how to.
Like, is it because of some regularization thing that you get this, or it is just?
I mean, basically, what you are saying is that the field cannot carry any energy, right? And that's certainly not true. So field can carry energy.
But if you have like the field can carry energy, that I agree. But I would think that that is in the trace.
So what we also see, of course, I don't know if this helps, but of course the black hole has a temperature. Right, so this is not really in vacuum, right? So we have a thermal state at infinity, which is given by the temperature of the black hole. So I don't know if that helps. Do you have any comments on this?
I mean,
that's a bit of violence of primary operators.
So I would say this is because it, yeah.
So that's at a scale depending on the state.
So of course, if you switch off the black hole and you just take empty ADS space, right, then the energy will be zero, and you know, everything else will be zero. So then you would be right. But this is like a, yeah, maybe it's because it's a thermal state given by the ADS black hole. So it's maybe that's why. Yeah. Thanks. More questions? Okay, happy times. Yes.
It's not really related to this, course. I mean, it's related, but I've seen like the confinement deconfinement in ADS being described as like having a cutoff in your ADS.
We will discuss that. Yeah. We will get there. Don't worry. So I will show you something more. But you know, this is one of the first papers on ADS CFT by Witten in 98, whatever. And so like you have a nice first order phase transition. You know that quark gluon plasma has nice first order phase transition in the early universe. Well, these better be related somehow, right? So this is like hand waving. These have to be related, right? But we will see some more indications like how to calculate this more precisely and. Yeah, we will calculate some Wilson loops.
Cutoff has anything to do with black hole? Or...
Yeah. You will see. Wait 1 week, okay? You will see. Hopefully, that will be answered. More questions?
Could you repeat what you were saying about adding the trace of TAB and adding to the variation, not to the action itself?
Sorry. So now I was just saying, if you take this definition of tau AB, and you calculate the trace, you'll find it's equal to zero. And the reason why this horrible thing, when you trace it out, is equal to zero, is because there are some miraculous identities, which are called, what are they called, Gauss relations or something like that. Ruth Gregory talked about them. But basically, they relate, you know, whatever happens with the extrinsic curvature here to whatever happens with the internal curvature invariance and stuff like that, and you'll find that it's equal to zero. It's just a calculation.
But then you have a comment about adding
very good. So this was a confusing comment, and I don't want you to remember anything out of it. That's why I put it like here. So basically, the statement is, you think about that this thing here is a nice Dirichlet problem, because if I fix delta HAB, and I have Einstein equation satisfied, the variation vanishes, and I'm happy, right? But you can, at the same time, if you are in ADS, if you are not in ADS, this tau AB may not be traceless. But if you are in ADS, tau AB is traceless because it describes CFT, which has to have traceless energy momentum tensor. So if you add this term here, nothing changes. But if you add this term here, if you vary it, you will have variation of this plus variation of that. Variation of this will cancel that. So then I will have a term, boundary term. So I can equally write this thing as HAB delta of square root of H tau AB, right? Sometimes people say, well, if you do canonical gravity, then this thing here is called pi AB, which is like the momentum carried in gravitational field, okay? And so then you turn to your Dirichlet problem to the problem where you suddenly vary not h on the boundary, but the momentum of h, canonical momentum to h on the boundary. So this looks like a Neumann problem. But in ADS, they are equivalent. They are the same, because this thing here is zero. So you can think about this action giving you either Dirichlet problem or giving you the Neumann problem, if you like this kind of Neumann problem. Is the same thing.
And CFT doesn't know anything about this
one. Oh, this is very interesting. So I can refer you to a couple of papers where they discuss like various boundary conditions in CFT and what it means. And people's. I can give you some nice recent paper if you are interested in this. Okay, more questions. This is just a side remark, right? But if you are not in ADS, tau AB will not be traceless. And then, you know, adding this term here will change the action. And then, of course, the Dirichlet problem is different from Neumann problem, because you are just using different action. But in ADS, they are the same. OK, let me stop here.